Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
Tonight, we talk about the tale of two towns trying to contact the dead. Join me as I discuss Lilydale, New York, and Skull, England. All that and more on Small Town Secrets. Hello, everyone, and welcome to, episode 4 of season 5 of the show. And tonight, you guys aren't aware of it, but it's the old switcheroo. This was not the topic that I had planned to do tonight. I've been reading a book to prepare for the show that was going to be episode 4, and I haven't seen the book for like 2 weeks. I don't know what happened to it. That's right, Patreons, I still haven't found the book from last week. So if I ever find the book and can finish the book, then I'll be able to do that episode. So in order to get something out this week, I decided just to swap some shows around and do this episode earlier than I had planned. So here it is. Tonight is kind of a different topic. I'm going to be talking a lot about mediums and contacting the dead and experiments and, you know, spiritualism. And all of that great stuff. I think it's actually going to turn out to be a pretty interesting episode. And I'm kind of excited to get into it. And really, other than not being able to find the book, I don't really have anything else to ramble on about in the intro. Other than to go ahead and thank everyone for tuning in and giving it a listen and all of that great stuff. But yeah, it's two tales of towns, like I said in the intro, that are really into talking with the dead and take these stories take two very different approaches to that phenomenon. So without further ado, let's not bury the lead. I'm just going to get into it. First, we're going to talk about Lilydale, New York, and then we'll come back and we will talk about the Skull Experiment in Skull, England.
Hello. Do you like werewolves? Ghosts? How about weird legends, folklore? Or is witchcraft your thing? Then join us on Charles Christian's Weird Tales radio show every Thursday. We're on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, YouTube, and at WeirdTalesRadio.com.
Lilydale, New York is actually a hamlet of Pomfret, New York. It's located just over the Pennsylvania border, east of Casadega Lake. Lilydale is a very special little place. It's a place solely dedicated to the practice and religion of spiritualism. Lilydale was incorporated in 1879, and in 1903, it changed its name to the City of Light, before changing its name to the Lilydale Assembly in 1906. So that's its official name, is actually Lilydale Assembly. But I don't know. No one really calls it that. They still just call it Lilydale. But if you do ever go to it, the gate that they have does have a, it says Lilydale Assembly in like big arched metal letters over it on the sign. Today, it's the largest center for spiritualism in the world, with at least 54 registered mediums living year-round, and as well as a few healers and possibly a psychic or two. There's also a couple of hotels, a couple of places to eat, a bunch of stuff. The spiritualist movement started in the late 1800s and became very popular in the early part of the 1900s. Lilydale quickly became a mecca for the movement. This brought plenty of mediums to town. Of course, not everyone was on the up and up. There were many back in those days who faked a lot of activity. Most of the fakery was physical activity. Mysterious pictures, people manifesting ectoplasm, aka cheese cloth, and other tricks. It would only stand to reason that a few of these flim-flam artists would find their way to Lilydale. Harry Houdini, in his ongoing quest to disprove spiritualism and debunk many of these people, visited Lilydale on quite a few occasions. And it got to the point where when Houdini was in town, he was pretty much blacklisted from Lilydale. Like, he would show up and everyone would just close their doors, not answer their doors, wouldn't talk to him. So, yeah, didn't go over well for Houdini and Lilydale after a while. But because of Houdini and a few fake spiritualists, the town's reputation did take a bit of a hit in the early days. And because of that, the residents turned away from any sort of mediumship that involved physical manifestations and focused on only mental attributes. So there's really two types of spiritualism. There is mental spiritualism and there is physical spiritualism. And when we talk about our next story, it is much more of the physical variety, but not in like a flim-flammy, huckster sort of way, in a much more interesting way. But Lilydale is just, it's all about, you know, kind of just reading people and all of that. And so even though spiritualism declined in the early kind of the 20s and the 30s, it kind of started going away, the town has since then kind of thrived on it by offering summer camps and other types of get-togethers and just all sorts of stuff that you can go there and do over the summer. Every year, the town receives around 20 to 30,000 visitors. Like I said, mainly throughout the summer. And many visitors gather for services at Inspiration Stump. The stump has been used by mediums to hold readings and services since 1898. And I got a lot of this There's a documentary. HBO did a documentary 2010, I believe, is when it came out. You can get it. It's not on HBO Max right now or anything, but you can rent it off of, like, iTunes, Apple TV, which is what I did. And they show the stump a lot because they do a lot of, like, getting, you know, people will come, they will sit, mediums will come out and just kind of start reading the crowd, start getting impressions. And they do it in the stump. And they used to stand on the stump, and they don't really do that anymore. And I'm not sure. It's very hard to tell if the stump is an actual stump or if it's like a cement, like a cement sculpture that looks like a stump. I think I can't really tell. Like, it's very large, and there is some sort of cap on top of it for them to stand on, and stairs that lead up to it. But I'm not sure if it's all one thing or if it's all put together. But it is a very neat little thing to gather around. They've got kind of pews in front of it. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's almost like a church service, but it's outside. There's no, they're not indoors when they are at Inspiration Stump. And of course, there are other places to explore in Lilydale besides the Stump of Inspiration. There is the Lilydale Museum, which not only serves as a museum for the town, but for spiritualism as a whole, the entire movement in general. And they have a Facebook page, and I have linked to the Facebook page if you would like to know more about the Museum of Lilydale. There's also the Fox Sisters home, kinda. And I'll get into the Fox Sisters here in a little bit. It was moved from Hydesdale, New York to Lilydale in 1915. And sadly, it's no longer there. It was burnt down in 1955 from suspected arson, but the site where the house once stood can still be seen and can still be visited. It's marked so that you know where it is. And the Fox Sisters were kind of famous, kind of infamous sisters who, when they were younger, claimed that they communicated with the spirits in said house through knocks during the night. And then one of them came out and said, no, that's, we faked all of that. And then a year later, she came out and said, the faking thing is fake. It did happen, not fake. And so there's a little bit of controversy there. But they did grow up to become very heavily involved in the spiritualist movement. And I just wanted to touch on them a little bit because they're probably will get their own episode here in the future. So I just want to give you a little dusting of who the Fox Sisters were and why this is like kind of an important house in the history of spiritualism. But we'll get into them much, much more detail on a later show. Lilydale is also home to the Lilydale Spiritualist Assembly, which holds seminars on both spiritualism and mediumship. So you want to go and learn more about it, maybe test your skills. The Lilydale Spiritualist Assembly is the place to go. And I think that is different than just calling it the Lilydale Assembly. Like, it is kind of, I believe it's a building, it's a group of people that run it. Just a very similar title. The town is also home to a 10-acre forest known as the Leolin Woods. The Leolin Woods is home to many species of old-growth trees. And it even has a pet cemetery in it. And I think that's where a lot of that stuff is nestled. Like, I don't know for sure, but you can kind of tell from the documentary, which is called, No One Ever Dies in Lilydale. I will link to it, of course, in the show notes if you want to check it out. And I believe the stump is in there. There's a pet cemetery. There are paths that you can walk. And it's all nestled in this old growth forest right by the town. You know, and it is a hamlet, so it is a tiny place. I think right now there's only like a couple of hundred people that live there. And not everyone is like a medium or is, you know, there are people that just live there. But it is kind of a close community. Like, it is gated off in a way where you can go, but during the summer, you know, you got to pay like an entrance fee and stuff. And they do have a gate, like, very much like a parking garage gate that you can, you know, they just raise it up and you can go through. And if you do want to live there, like, you need to be kind of invited or registered with the town to be able to lease a home there. But like I said, there are people there that do just live there that have been welcomed by the community of spiritualists to live in Lilydale. And if you do get a chance, it's like $3, $4, something like that. Check out that documentary, because they do, what they do is they follow a few people around looking for answers. You know, there's a man from Chicago who's trying to contact his son who was shot on a bus. There's a woman who's trying to contact her husband, and her and her friends, like, they follow these people around. Then there's other ones. There's 3 or 4 they really follow around, and it is an interesting look, because they follow those people around, and they also feature a few of the more well-known mediums in town. And I won't say that I agree with everyone's methods, and when you do watch it, you'll get a feeling for, I think there's at least one person, one medium in there that not on the up and up, because I think everyone that talks to him really is just like, I don't believe a word that guy just said. But most of them do have some pretty unique interviews, do have some great things to say, and it's worth the watch. It's like an hour and a half, and you really get a feeling for what this little town is, what it's about, and what it goes through in the modern day to be the biggest spiritualist community in the world. So this town, it's an important place, I think. It's a place of knowledge. It's a place that may give you answers if you're looking for those answers of what happens beyond the veil. And, you know, it's a place that's well worth a visit. Just make sure that when you go, you go during the summer, because apparently it's a bit of a ghost town in the off months. Like, they don't do anything like, you know, during Halloween and stuff like that. And a lot of the places, not during the summer, they're just open on the weekends, if they're open at all. So the spring, the summer, that's the time to go and check it out. And I'm one of these days when it's, you know, safe, when everything's back to a normal state. I think I'm totally going to go here, because, like I said, it's just over the Pennsylvania border, and I feel like, I think it's like an 8-hour drive from where I'm at, so not too bad. Go down there and spend a weekend in Lilydale and see what's going on, see what it's all about. But that is Lilydale. It's kind of short, it's kind of sweet, but get a chance, check it out. I'm going to check it out, but we'll move on here to Skull, England, and talk about some really amazing out-of-this-world experiments and some, just some very interesting pictures, some very interesting evidence from the Skull experiment in Skull, England.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Skoll is a village of about 1,367 people located on the eastern edge of England. And unlike Lilydale, in which the whole town talks with the dead, here an experiment was carried out not only to talk to the dead, but to bring back tangible objects and evidence from the other side. And it was known as the Skoll Experiment. It started in 1993 with two couples, Robin and Sandra Foy, and Diana and Alan Bennett. The experiment started life at the Foy's farmhouse. The Bennetts are both mediums who underwent most of the experiments, while the Foys carried out the experiments and recorded the results and took, you know, copious notes on what was going on. The main goal of the Skoll Experiment was to manifest tangible objects from the spirit realm. Not just one, but enough objects to make mainstream science take notice of the paranormal. The experiment started small in the cellar of the Foy's house. The cellar was very soon dubbed the Skoll Hole. And this one also has a documentary, which you can watch for free on YouTube. I will link it in the show notes, and it's very good as well. It's British. It's a British documentary, but it's got a lot of great stuff in it. And they show the cellar, and it's just like old limestone, and it's painted blue, and it's got like the recesses in the back to put, you would always see them in castles. There'd always be like a candelabra in it, and that's what it looks like. And it looks perfect for what they were trying to do. Sets the mood very well, I think. At first, the Bennetts would go into a trance and begin to have spirits talk through them. So very typical medium stuff, like, you know, the basics of being a medium is talking with the dead and having them talk through you and being in a trance. And so that's where they started. However, they were soon approached by a group of spirits, or whatever you want to call these beings, from the other side, and they were referring to themselves as the Spirit Team. So yeah, you heard me right. They claimed that they were getting instructions, they were being contacted by a team of entities from beyond the veil, from the other side, that were going to help them in these experiments. The Foys and the Bennetts claim that they started to receive instructions from the Spirit Team on how to carry out certain experiments and how to improve others. So as they go on, I mean, they get all the typical stuff, you know, they get EVPs, they get, balls of light that flow around the darkness, all of that great stuff, but they get so much more over the years as well. One of these early experiments involved photography. Using a normal camera, they would take some pictures, but things got weird very quickly with this type of experiment as, they would sit in the dark, and all of a sudden they would hear the camera start to snap pictures, but it would be above their heads as if something was levitating it above everything. And the other thing to note about this was all happening in the pitch blackness, just complete darkness. So even though these cameras were in the dark, they still produced pictures. So you would think, you take a picture of pitch blackness, you're not going to get anything. But then they would go, they would develop this film, and they would get pictures. And often these pictures were, you know, pictures of places in the past. And they, once again, I did say, you know, there's a documentary on this one too. And they show these pictures of like, they're like images from World War II of places during the war. And these are new pictures. But sometimes the pictures were far more abstract and mysterious. Like sometimes it was just weird balls of light or, you know, very abstract looking stuff. And sometimes they would get like faces, like just actual faces of people, you know, kind of shrouded in this weird, weird, just abstractness. But they were the faces of someone, you know, a lot of them weren't identifiable, but somebody in these pictures. And they were even able to produce pictures without a camera at all. Instead, they would put an unopened box of film on a table. And then, you know, the same, you know, they would just do their thing. And then they would go and develop that film. And it would also contain pictures. And many of these were writing scrolled across the entire roll of film. And so when you look at it, I'll link to that. Like I said, I'll link to that documentary. When you look at them, they show some pictures of these, of this film. Like they have the film rolled out. Like they're not showing you the photographs. They're just showing you like the negatives of the film. And it's literally just writing. Just every frame is just a continuation. Like someone has just written on a scroll. But they're pictures. And, you know, they did a lot. They were very good about keeping everything in check and being transparent and saying, we're not faking this. And they would get some help. So, like, after this, the team was quick to get the attention of the SPR, the Society for Psychical Research, which we've talked about many times on this show. And the SPR was invited to take part in most of the research and a lot of the experiments here on After to help legitimize it. The SPR at one point redid the experiment with the box of unopened film to help prove that it was real. But what they did, they took the film and they locked it inside of a wooden box and then had someone hold it the entire time. So no one could mess with it because it was in a box, and then also someone was holding it. So if anyone tried anything, this person holding it would know that something was going on. And they would still get these strange scrolling pictures. One of these pictures was a diagram. Are you ready for this? Was a diagram of how to improve EVPs. It was like this kind of step-by-step instruction with drawings of how to take a radio, do this to it, add this to it, and you'll get better EVPs. Also, these instructions apparently came from Thomas Edison himself. And they know this because at the end of these pictures, at the end of the sequence of diagrams, he appears to have signed it. And the signature just kind of, it matches up. After the photograph experiments, the Skoll team was tasked by the other side with making an apparatus that consisted of a glass dome on the top, what appears to be like some sort of little plexiglass stand. When you look at pictures of it, and I don't really know if it has a name in the documentary and the stuff that I read, no one came out and said, oh, we call this thing, but that's what it looks like. It looks like a little, you know, glass dome that you would put something under, like the glass dome that the magic rose from Beauty and the Beast is in. It's like that. And then it just looks like it sits on this little table that's made out of plexiglass. And that's all it is. Like, it's not powered by anything. It's not hooked up to anything. So this device, for lack of a better term, would often manifest bursts of energies, resulting in quite the light show. And they show a couple of pictures. I think a lot of this stuff, there's a lot of stuff recorded on audio that you would, like, you know, you would be like, man, I wish they had video of that. But I think a lot of this was done in the dark. And, of course, trying, you know, recording stuff in the dark, especially back in 94, was not like, I mean, you're not going to get anything from that. So there's a lot of audio tape of what's going on, and there is some video that comes along, and there are photographs of this thing just, like, giving off, like, you know, burst of red light and burst of white light and all this stuff, and very interesting pictures. The next strange phenomena that would pop up quite literally in the skull hole were apports. Apports are objects that seem to materialize out of thin air. And not only would these objects just come into existence, but they would also land with the same loud, audible thump, no matter how much the object weighed. So it could be anything. It could be a piece of paper, and it would go when it hits the ground. It could be a button, and it would go when it hits the table or the ground or whatever. The same noise, no matter what it was, which is really weird. The Skull team started getting apports all the time. Coins, jewelry, watches, even newspapers. Over the 5 years, the Skull experiment collected over 80 apported objects. Apports were not the only thing that would come out of thin air, but how about disembodied hands? Hands that would at times interact with the participants in the cellar. And I want to take this moment to say that not only was it the two couples, not only was it some people from the SPR a lot, but eventually they got scientists. They got some physicists in there. They've got, you know, electrical engineers. They got a few people to come, a biologist, take part in these experiments as well to help back it all up. So they were, like I said, they were very careful about documenting it. They were very careful about making sure that everything that they were presenting was legitimate and as airtight as they could get it. The Skull team was even told by the Spirit team that hands, and at times other body parts, manifested because it was easier to do that than to do a full body manifestation. However, that did happen on quite a few occasions. Then they moved on to video with what they called Project Alice. While, like I said, they did get orbs of light and other things on video from time to time, this specific project, this Project Alice, was they were going for a certain setup to make it work. So this was a camera setup, and it was set up in between two mirrors so that the camcorder could only film its own viewfinder. So they show it. They show, like, the diagram that there's a camcorder in the middle, and there's these two angled mirrors, almost a triangle, so that the camera sees one mirror, that mirror sees the mirror behind it, and it's making the circle, and now it's the camera's filming its own self, its own viewfinder. What happened was a sort of the video equivalent of an EVP. Nothing would appear on the camcorder while filming, but when they looked at the video later, they would often get large orbs of strange light and sometimes what looked like tunnels of light and, on rare occasion, some very interesting distorted faces. There's one that's very famous. They show it in the doc a lot, actually. And I bet I could even find a picture for the show notes here. I'll see what I can do. That literally just looks like a very silhouetted, like, human face. Like, you see the shape of the face, and you don't really see eyes and stuff, but you see the gesturing of the nose and the mouth, and you see kind of the brow of the eyes and stuff. It's pretty interesting. And then there's another one that is just straight up an alien. Like, there's no other explanation for it. Like, it is an alien gray. And that was all caught with this Project Alice stuff. And a couple of other very interesting ones, like one of just these eyes, these very weird black eyes, just darting back and forth. It's like a close-up of it. It's like I said, some weird video evidence to take a look at. In 1997, the Skull team would travel to Spain, Holland, Germany, Switzerland, and the U.S., namely L.A., to see if they could recreate the activity in other locales around the world. And they did. For example, in L.A., many witnessed a round table, which had crystals placed on top of it. They had also put some kind of glow-in-the-dark tape on it for some reason in the experiment. But a bunch of people, school people, the witnesses that came into L.A., watched this round table levitate into the air, turn on its side, without the crystals falling off, and it would start spinning. And it spun so fast that it looked like a pinwheel just going round and round. So, you know, this glowing tape, these little bits of glowing tape were spinning so fast that it just became one line and the crystals on it. They kind of do a recreation of it. I'm not sure when this documentary came out. I know that it came out after White Noise, the big EVP movie, because they mention it. But it's got some computer, you know, reenactments that are, didn't age well, but they're in there. Near the end of the 5 years, the Skull Experiment did one of its most amazing, if just not flat out the most amazing experiment they ever tried down in the Skull Hole. During a session, Arthur Ellison from the SPR was present and participating. During the experiment, a ball of light appeared, like just a little itty-bitty kind of pea-sized ball, appeared and floated inside a large quartz crystal. They say, and this is one of those things that's on audio, that the crystal began to glow once this little ball of light went into it. The crystal then began to float, and eventually it landed inside of a glass mixing bowl that they had beside it on the table. Once again, I think this is an experiment that was set up by the spirit team on the other side. Ellison was then asked to touch the crystal and try to grab it, which he did, and he was able to grab it. He put it back down into the bowl. He was then immediately asked to do it again, but this time his fingers passed right through the quartz crystal. He could see it like it was a ghost crystal, but he could not get it. And then, on a third grab, the crystal was solid again, and he was able to pick it up. And this is all, it's not on video, but it is on tape. And that's got to be something else. And just think about that for a little bit of seeing that and just being like, I can see the crystal. I just touched the crystal not 2 seconds ago, and now I can't do nothing to it. So, like, that to me is just an amazing thing. It would have been so amazing to witness all of that. The Skull Experiment, it went on for 5 years before ending in 1998. And in that time, it created some of the most intriguing evidence for what may happen to us after we die. And that's it. Those are both of the stories. And I really don't know what to make of all of it. I think, like I said, and I've said this before, that I'm not like a huge religious person, but, you know, if you think about the soul or consciousness or whatever this is, and, you know, it's, if it's not a physical thing, it's got to be a sort of energy, you know, it has to be. It's the only way that makes any sense. And so if energy can't be created or destroyed, it can only be transferred, well then, where does it go? You know, when we're not around anymore, when this physical body, when we have shed this mortal coil, where does it all go? And even in that documentary, that Skull Experiment documentary, a bunch of people talk about, and they get into something else with an old radio, which I'm kind of also saving for either another episode of the show or maybe an episode on the Patreon. Not sure which yet, which is also very fascinating stuff. But a lot of the times, there's more than once they mention that these people are in another dimension. You know, it's not like an afterlife thing. It's not like they're in heaven or they're in hell. But they just become some other being in some other place, which is very interesting to me. So I want to really get into, normally I don't do this, like, if I find a book for a topic I've already discussed on the show after I've already, like, discussed it, I usually don't buy the book because I'm so afraid I'm going to read the book and be like, oh man, I should have put that in the show, I really screwed that up. But I am going to buy, there is a book for this, I think that outlines some of the experiments, what they did and how to do them. I grabbed it on my Kindle, so I am going to read through that and see maybe to be able to recreate or try some of these experiments that they did. And even though they said they stopped in 98, they're still kind of around. There's a website that documents everything. The book I talked about is on there. The documentary I talked about is linked on there. It just takes you to YouTube and you can watch it. And it's just, you know, a whole website of what went on, notes and things that happened. And they've got a Facebook page and they've got a Twitter account and it's active. So I don't think the Skoll experiment is like ongoing anymore, but there are still people, or I'm not sure if it's even the people that started it, but someone is there keeping it alive and keeping it at the forefront of everyone else. So like I said, very interesting stuff. If you do nothing else, watch that documentary linked in the show notes on the Skoll experiment. Take a look at some of the video they get, some of the pictures they get, and just how well, like it really goes into detail about how well they try to back up all this evidence. And so there we go. We are now at the middle of the show, which is intermission. So I'm going to take a little musical break, play some music here. We'll come back and we will talk about some local headlines. Bye. And I am back and ready for the news, a.k.a. the local headlines. And I promise, no mention, no news stories of any monoliths or obelisk or whatever you call them. Past that, we got some new stuff. This first one, not really small townish, but I think a pretty important development. This is from the Washington Post. Hold on, let me see if there's a name on this. I don't see it right off the top of my head. Oh, yes, by Mara Eltagori. And this is bones discovered on Pacific Island belong to Amelia Earhart, a new forensic analysis claims. Amelia Earhart's story is revolutionary. She was the first woman to fly alone across the Atlantic Ocean and might have been the first to fly around the world had her plane not vanished over the Pacific Ocean in 1937. After decades of mystery, her story might have come to a close. A new scientific study claims that the bones found in 1940 on the Pacific island of, I'm going to try to pronounce this, Nikumaroro belonged to Earhart, despite a forensic analysis of the remains conducted in 1941 that linked the bones to a man. The bones revisited in the study, Amelia Earhart and the Nikumaroro Bones, by University of Tennessee professor Richard L. Jance, was discarded. For decades, they have remained an enigma. As some have speculated, Earhart died a castaway on the island after her plane crashed. The bones were uncovered by a British expedition exploring the island for settlement after the team came upon a human skull. According to the study, the expedition's officers ordered a more thorough search of the area, which resulted in the discovery of several other bones and part of what appeared to be a woman's shoe. Other items found include a box made to hold a Brandes Navy surveying sextant that had been manufactured around 1918 and a bottle of Benedictine, a herbal liqueur. There was suspicion at the time that the bones could be the remains of Amelia Earhart, Janice wrote in the study. The 13 bones were shipped to Fiji and studied by D.W. Hoodless of the Central Medical School the following year. At the time, Jance argued, forensic osteology, the study of bones, was not yet a well-deserved discipline. The Hoodless methods and Hoodless's methods of determining sex were inadequate compared to modern techniques. His assessment of the person's sex, therefore, could not be assumed to be correct, Jance wrote. In attempting to compare the lost bones with Earhart's bones, Jance co-developed a computer program that estimated sex and ancestry using skeletal measurements. The program, FORDISC, is commonly used by forensic anthropologists across the globe. Jance compared the lengths of the bones to Earhart's measurements using her height, weight, body build, limb lengths, and proportions, based on photographs and information found on her pilot's and driver's licenses. His findings reveal that Earhart's bones were more similar to the Nikumaroro bones than 99% of individuals in a large reference sample. In this case, the Nikumaroro bones are the only documented person to whom they may belong is Amelia Earhart, Jance wrote in the study. Earhart's disappearance has long captivated the public. The theories involving her landing in Nikumaroro have emerged in recent years. Retired journalist Mike Campbell, who wrote Amelia Earhart, The Truth at Last, has maintained with others that Amelia and her navigator, Fred Noonan, were captured in the Marshall Islands by the Japanese, who thought they were American spies. He believes they were tortured and died in custody. But Rick Lepsey, director of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, spoke to the Washington Post's Cleve R. Woodson Jr. in 2016 about how he believes the bones found on Nikumaroro belong to Earhart, an uninhabited coral atoll in the Gardner Island. Nikumaroro is part of Kiribati, a former British possession in the Central Pacific that used to be called the Gilbert Islands. In 1998, the group took Hoodless's measurements of the Nikumaroro bones and analyzed them through a robust anthropological database. they determine that the bones belong to a taller-than-average woman of European descent, perhaps Earhart, who, at 5 feet 7 to 5 feet 8, was several inches taller than the average woman. In 2016, the group brought the measurements to Jeff Glickman, a forensic examiner who located a photo of Earhart from the Lockheed Aircraft Corporation that showed her with her arms exposed. It appeared, based on educated guesses, that Earhart's upper arm bone corresponded with one of the NICU Moro bones. Glickman, who is now a member of TIGAR, told the Washington Post at the time that he understood that some might be skeptical about his findings, as they were based on his 76-year-old medical notes. But the research made clear, he said, that Earhart died on NICU Moro. Neither Gillespie nor Glickman could be immediately reached for the Post for comment on Jant's findings. In June 2017, researchers traveled to NICU Moro with dogs specially trained to sniff the chemicals left behind by decaying human remains. They thought they might discover a bone, and were especially hopeful when the dogs seemed to detect the scent of human remains beneath a wren tree. But there were no bones. A week later, the History Channel published a photo suggesting Earhart died in Japan. Based on a photograph unearthed from the National Archives, researchers said Earhart may have been captured by the Japanese after all, as the photo showed Earhart and Noonan in a Joliet Harbor in the Marshall Islands after their disappearance. In the photo, according to the Post's Amy B. Wang, a figure with Earhart's haircut and approximate body type sits on the dock, facing away from the camera. Toward the left of the dock is the man they believe to be Noonan. On the far right of the photo is a barge with an airplane in it, supposedly Earhart's. After the History Channel program aired, a Japanese military history blogger matched the photo to the one published in a 1935 Japanese travelogue 2 years before Earhart and Noonan disappeared. The History Channel released a statement addressing the discrepancy. History has a team of investigators exploring the latest developments about Amelia Earhart and will be transparent in our findings, the statement read. Ultimately, historical accuracy is the most important to us and our viewers. Gillespie still stands behind his theory, he told Woodson in 2017, after the photograph's discovery. His group, TIGAR, had tried to debunk the photo, and Gillespie still thinks the overwhelming weight of evidence points to NICU Moro. A long article, but I think an important one, ever closer to solving that mystery. And now let's go back to an actual small town. This is from The Sun over in the UK by Katie Davis. Roswell Investigator's Journal reveals he found indestructible debris not made by human hands at alien crash site. In July 1947, a UFO reportedly hurtled into the ranch in New Mexico, and the most famous alien legend of them all was born. Soon after the military sensationally announced in a press release that the remains of a crashed flying saucer had been discovered in the desert. The following day, however, the statement was retracted, and it was said to be, instead, a damaged U.S. Air Force balloon. The incident has become one of the most discussed and controversial UFO theories in history. Jesse Marcel, an intelligence officer of the 509th Bomberment Group at the Roswell Army Airfield, was tasked with investigating the crash. No more than 30 years on from his death on June 24, 1986, his grandchildren, Jesse Marcel III and John Marcel, claimed he was ordered to deny what actually was discovered at the crash site. Speaking to the Daily Mail, his grandson, Jesse Marcel III, said he was made to be the fall guy. He was the head of the intelligence in Roswell, New Mexico, and followed his orders. In essence, he was at the heart of the story and the heart of the conspiracy or the cover-up. The wreckage was first discovered by W.W. Mac Brazel, who spotted odd pieces of metal and debris scattered across Foster Ranch. Jesse Marcel III said even animals had a sense about whatever it was and did not want to go around it. He, Marcel, had examined the debris in the field and determined it was not made by human hands. Pieces of debris were taken to the Roswell base, where a team tried to figure out what they were from and what was the material. According to Marcel, some beams, it says beans here, in the article, but I know it's beams, were etched with alien writing. Grandson, John Marcel, said, he said there were glass fibers and fiber optics that may have been from the computers on the ship. When my grandfather came home with the debris, our dad looked through it with a shining light and saw purple light inside a symbol of a seal balancing a ball on its nose. Jesse added, my grandfather said, you might be the first person on Earth to look at alien writing. The fascinating diary will be released for the first time in a three-part series. Roswell, the first witness on the History Channel. There's the History Channel again. The show, which airs tomorrow, follows the investigation of the Marcel children along with former CIA operative Ben Smith. The claim comes after extraordinary footage emerged reportedly showing an alien creature being carted away on a stretcher from the scene. So yeah, you can click on that and it will take you to this video. Then when you get to it, the article is like, oh, it's the Roswell alien and it's footage from Area 51. But if you know anything, you know that there probably wasn't an Area 51 in 1947 and that any Roswell stuff would have been taken and was taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton. It wasn't taken to Dayton, Ohio. It wasn't taken to Area 51. So I don't know about that article, but this one's kind of cool that the diary's coming out and there's another documentary about Roswell with hopefully some new information in it. And our last one is from All K-Pop. A Korean YouTuber discovers a decaying dead body while visiting an abandoned house. And this is just attributed to the AKP staff. Recently, a YouTuber in his 20s discovered a dead body while visiting an abandoned location to film a haunted house. According to YTN News, on December 15th, two individuals, including the YouTuber, found a body lying in a room in an abandoned house in a Hingudong, Wuju City in Gangwon Province at around 3 a.m. Korean Standard Time and called the police. The body, believed to be a man aged 40 to 60, was discolored due to severe decomposition. Police are reportedly sending a forensic team to block off the scene for investigation. The abandoned house wasn't inhabited for years, and the YouTuber told police he had visited the house to make a video content about haunted houses and record any ghost-slash-paranormal activities. The police believe that there is no criminal suspicion, such as murder. However, the police plan to request an autopsy from the National Forensic Service to identify the body and cause of death. Neatsons, who heard the news, said, it must have been really lonely for the man when he died. The YouTuber must have been so surprised. I don't think the YouTuber can sleep for days. And the YouTuber must have been shaken. So there you go. I'm going to close all of these super hungry and thirsty tabs before they destroy all of my RAM. Can you hear it? Just the fan just going because of all these ads upon ads upon ads and all these news story websites. So that's it. That has been this week's local headlines. I'm going to come back. I'm going to talk about something a little bit different this week on your small town, Secrets. And so tonight on your small town Secrets, I wanted to take a little bit of time and talk about something that's been going on with a friend of mine, actually. And not have anyone, no listener stories, but one from, secondhand, I guess, experience. I've had a friend whose house for a very long time, has never had anything really strange going on, but over this whole year, something seems to have changed there, and they keep getting weird experiences here and there. In fact, they've been having it going on for about a year. It started last Christmas, when they started seeing Christmas ornaments falling off the tree, and not just falling off the tree, but seeing them kind of suspend in air for a second and then fall, like someone picked it up and then let go of it, but there's no one there. That was followed by Speaking of ports of what we think might be a porting glass, they have found three or four shards of really dirty broken glass and cannot account for where it comes from. I think I may have talked about the shards before on another show way back. I don't know which season that would have been, but that's been going on. Just all sorts of very weird things. Their kids are now hearing voices that they never heard before. Just kind of, you know, no one is there. They hear someone, a woman whispering, a disembodied voice of a woman. They've had stuff move. There's this, like, I don't know if you want to call it. It's just kind of a few shelves and it just has stuff for the bathroom on it. Like be moved away from the wall in the middle of the night when no one was up to do it. They've had just all sorts of weird things, feeling weird, you know, the hairs back on their neck standing up. And just most recently, everyone was at home like last weekend or something. And they heard a very distinct knock at the door and immediately went to answer it. No one had time to really run away without being seen or to get where or hide or anything. And there's no one at the door. So stuff just continues to happen. And I think we're getting to the boiling point to where we're going to try to hold some sort of investigation just to see if we can document anything. I don't know when. It's been kind of hard with COVID and just, you know, they've got like three, you know, a bunch of kids and just trying to get everything to the point to where we feel we can do it safely and the proper way that we want to do it. So keep an eye out or keep an ear out for that. I'll keep everyone updated on what is going on because, like, this house never had weird activity before. I've been in there a lot. Actually, if you remember, like, season one, like, third episode, fourth episode, I did that very long interview with the guy who was abducted by aliens. I recorded that interview in that house. Because something had happened and they needed someone had to go to the emergency room and, they wanted me to stay the night so I could let the dogs and stuff out. And I was like, well, I'll just grab my MacBook. I'll grab my kind of portable mic that I have, my little USB mic, and I'll just do that interview there. So that's not the first time that this, house has popped up on the show, but I just wanted to let everyone know that there is some strangeness afoot very close to me. And I'll keep everyone posted on it. So there you go, a small town secret, straight from the horse's mouth this week. And so there you go. That is this week's episode. And I hope everyone enjoyed it. If you have a small town secret to share, you can do it very easily by going to stscast.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the main page there. There's an email form where you can send me your haunting experience, your true crime story, your Bigfoot hunting expedition, or whatever you would like to share about your small town, let me know. We'll get on the show. If you don't want to do that, you can also get at me on social media. I'm most active on Twitter. That is @STScast. Facebook is also @STScast. And Instagram is @STScast.gram. Let me know. We can get on the show. We can record an interview. You can write something in. You can send me a news story. You know, many ways we can do it and many things we can do. Other things you can find on stscast.com include, like, merch. You want to buy a t-shirt or a coffee mug or anything. That's where you can do it. Other ways to support the show. The best way to do it financially is to join the Patreon. You can find a link there on the website to Patreon under the support tab, or you can go to patreon.com/stscast. Three tiers, stickers and buttons, extra shows, like, you know, ad-free versions of the main show, the music. And I do promise in the later half of this season to get some new music out. It's just been kind of a hectic month or so since this season started, and I haven't had a chance to sit down and really compose some new stuff yet. But I'll get something out before the season is through. So yeah, you can get the music, you can get STS Backroads, which is an exclusive podcast that is usually an extension of this show. And I think this next week we will probably talk about the Philip experiment, which has some similarities to the Skull experiment. And I think that's what we'll end up talking about in Backroads this week. So if that interests you, then check out the Patreon and let me know. And as always, you know, just leave a rating review on your podcatcher of choice, especially if it's iTunes. And if you like the show, tell a friend about the show. If everyone that listens gets one more person to listen, then we automatically double the audience. So I want to thank everyone for listening. I want to thank everyone for taking the time out to listen to this dumb little show that I do. And I actually don't feel super great. My voice is going really hoarse and I'm super tired. I feel kind of strange. So I think I'm just going to be done with it for the night. I'll finish it all up in the morning. And so if you're listening to this first day, it'll probably come out like Sunday afternoonish. But hey, it's December. It's the middle of December. 'Tis the season for schedules to be all screwed up. So once again, thanks everyone for listening. And until next time, remember, every town has a secret. What is yours?
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.